And I really just want to jump right in, full steam ahead, and do a very brief review of the instructions Paul has given about marriage in the first 24 verses of 1 Corinthians 7. So we'll pick up, and my plan is 4 or 5 minutes, with verse 25, which where we left off on Wednesday. But just to get a head start, if you want more discussion of any of this that you're about to see, go back in and spend some time reading. You can listen to the classes from Wednesday and Sunday, or you can ask me whatever questions you like. But this is just to kind of remember where we've been and talk about kind of running start into where we are. Remember, the first seven verses of 1 Corinthians 7 are addressing married couples and the misunderstanding, it seems, among the Corinthians that it's more holy for husbands and wives to remain celibate, okay? Paul says no, that's not more holy. In fact, there's problems with that that he addresses, but basically, husband and wife should be together. They should have each other, okay? And then from there, he addresses a few other categories. We said, I could be wrong, but it seems like verses 8 and 9 specifically is dealing with those who have lost their spouse, widows and widowers. And remember, he said it's, perhaps best to not remarry, but they can if they so choose. Verses 10 and 11 deal with Christian couples and just in really many ways is reiterating Jesus's command in places like Mark 10, that say no divorce. Okay, divorce is not an option, and so neither the wife or the husband should consider that. Then in verses 12 to 16, at least in the first part of the chapter, the last category he comes to is, okay, well, what if I'm married to a pagan, a non-Christian? And remember, there could be some confusion, perhaps, going back to Old Testament times and the examples of people that put away their spouses because they had married pagans. But Paul says, no, divorce is still not an option. Stay with your pagan spouse if they consent. Now, remember, there were some other things said because it takes two, right? And so the other person in the marriage does have free will. They may choose to up and leave. And at a certain point, there's nothing you can do about that. Paul does not say anything, does not give license there for the person who has been left to remarry. I think for that scenario, you would have to, again, as we've said, refer to some of the larger, more general teachings about marriage, again, found in places like Mark 10 or Matthew 19. Then in verse 17 to 24, Paul started to introduced what we're kind of saying is the main principle of the chapter, okay? Three times, he says, in that section, each one is to remain with God in that condition in which he was called. The point we tried to make about that is our circumstances don't determine our spiritual well-being, okay? So don't think, maybe Paul would say, to married people, oh, if I could just get away from this marriage, then I could serve God the way he wants me to, okay? Don't think, if you're single, oh, if I just was married, I could serve God the way he wants me to. No, whatever condition you're called in, you have the ability and the calling to keep God's commandments. Now, that's a crucial qualifier in verse 19. In the illustration of circumcision, he says, well, circumcision or uncircumcision, and by parallel, he means, okay, whether you're married or not married, in some ways, that doesn't matter, okay? What matters is keeping the commandments of God. So if you're married, keep the commandments of God as it pertains to marriage. If you're single, keep the commandments of God. Do the things that he has called on his people to do. Don't think that if I could just change my circumstance, then that would be the ticket to holiness or to faithfulness to God, okay? And that leads us then into, I did pretty well, 5 minutes, into the new material, or at least material that we haven't talked explicitly about in chapter 7, starting in verse 25. Let's read the rest of this. I think we've read it before, but let's read the rest of this and then talk about it. Verse 25 of 1 Corinthians 7. Now concerning virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give an opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord is trustworthy. I think then that this is good in view of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life, and I am trying to spare you. But I say, brethren, that the time has been shortened, so that from now on, those who have wives should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it, for the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord, but the one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be both holy in body and in spirit. The one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. This I say for your own benefit, not to put a restraint on you, but to promote what is appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. But if any man thinks that he is acting unbecomingly toward his virgin daughter, if she is past her youth, if it must be so, let him marry. Let him do as he wishes. He does not sin. Let her marry. But he who stands firm in his heart, being under no constraint, but has authority over his own will, and has decided this in his own heart, to keep his own virgin daughter, he will do well. So then, both he who gives his own virgin daughter in marriage does well, and he who does not give her in marriage will do better. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives, but if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But it is my opinion, she is happier if she remains as she is, and I think that I also have the Spirit of God. Okay, similar to what we saw earlier in the chapter, Paul seems to be addressing various circumstances and giving his instructions on the matter, although we'll talk about the kind of instruction Paul is giving. So, in verse 25, it introduces the idea of virgins. Now, in this section and in the section that comes next in verse 36 to 38, there is a question. There's a difference of translation, actually. You may have noticed as I was reading that your version says something different. The word in the original has to do with, you know, a virgin, an unmarried person, okay? The question is Paul addressing virgin couples, okay, so betrothed or engaged folks, okay, that have not yet married, and giving them his thoughts on what they should do? Or is he talking about perhaps like the virgin daughters and instructing the fathers on how to, you know, either give or not give their daughters in marriage? My opinion is that is probably the first of those, which confusingly is the second on the screen here, okay? But I think it's the betrothed couples that are being addressed here, or maybe just more generally non-married people in verse 25 to 28. But if you're engaged, you're betrothed, should you get married? Paul's opinion, and he clarifies that, is, given the situation, best to remain as you are. Okay, as we've seen before, this chapter is fraught with little like asterisks and footnotes and things you got to explain about, you know, what Paul's saying. First of all, we mentioned this on Wednesday. We had a decent discussion about it, in terms of decently in depth. This idea that in 25 and following, Paul seems to shift to be giving his opinion. It is divinely inspired, as all scripture is. Okay, Paul is an apostle, but he seems to be stepping away here from the realm of command that, you know, from God that must be followed, like what we saw earlier about, like, don't divorce, you know, okay, and giving his opinion about what he thinks would be best. Now, that may seem weird to us, okay? Most of what the commands we find in the New Testament are the apostles telling us, you know, this is what God has said, this is what the Holy Spirit says, the commands to keep. But here, Paul is giving his opinion. Now, you know, he says that. I give my opinion as one who by the mercy of the Lord, is trustworthy, okay? So it's a trustworthy opinion, but it is an opinion. But we know it's an opinion because He says, well, you can marry or you cannot marry. Either is fine, okay? As we said Wednesday, that's not a very clear command. If it's a command, it's hard to keep a command that says you can do this or you can do the other, okay? Now, the asterisk I have here is this this idea of the situation that Paul is addressing. You notice in verse 26, he says, I think then that it is good in the view of the present distress that it is good for a man to remain as he is. So the opinion Paul is giving, and maybe throughout the rest of this chapter, maybe in the whole, throughout the rest of this chapter, it seems to be kind of related to what he calls this present distress. And that is, you know, coloring what he says, okay, about, well, it's best to remain as you are. The question is, what in the world is Paul talking about when he says there's this present distress? Okay, I'll give you the two options. You can choose. Every hour, it's like every morning I wake up, I think it's the other one, okay? So I keep going back and forth. I'm not very well made up in my mind. The two options are this. Probably the most popular option is that there is something going on in that time and place, in Corinth, in the region, something like a famine, something like a difficulty, perhaps maybe even on the Christians, persecution of some sort, okay? Something is going on at that time in that place, and Paul is saying because of what's going on, and you know, they wouldn't obviously know what that is. He wouldn't need to explain that to them if that was the case, okay? We would like to know, but he doesn't tell us, okay? But based on what's going on, I think it's best to remain as you are. Don't add the extra trouble of, you know, providing for somebody else, taking on extra responsibility, so on and so forth, okay? That's option one, okay? Option two is that the present distress simply refers to the time that we're living in, this squeezed time in which we are waiting for Christ to return, okay? And it's difficult in this shortened time that he'll use that phrase later on. It's difficult, okay? Our priorities are being tested and challenged. We're trying to serve the Lord, but there's other responsibilities that we have to take care of. And as we all know, it's difficult to live in this, what we've referred to recently as the wilderness or the overlapping of the ages, the in-between time. And that is the situation, Paul says, based on, you know, our standing as Christians before Jesus comes back, it's best to remain as you are, but you do well if you marry. There's no harm in that, perhaps, okay? All right, I did it before. I guess I should bravely step out again. Anything anybody wants to add to that? Again, you can pick which of those two you want. The first is probably the more common interpretation of what Paul is saying here, but there are those that would say the other. Yeah, Brian.
Academic, because I would say it's academic. Just one thing we do know, at that time there was distress. And in distress, there's tribulations, there's afflictions, there's hardships, and he wants them to focus upon God and the Lord. And if they have a spouse with children, you have other responsibilities, other priorities, other considerations. In context with the distress that exists, that all of those could draw you away.
So let's get to that, and if there's something else, let me know. But kind of go through the rest of the specific advice in this chapter. 36 to 38 is kind of addressing the same thing again, whether it's the fathers or it's the couples. He says, you know, do as you wish. Marry if you want, let them marry. Again, ESV or something like that talks about this as betrothed couples is probably more to the point. But again, he ends with one of these kind of even-handed statements. You marry, you do well. You don't marry, you do better. And so that then brings us to the final instructions in 39 and 40, where he addresses someone who's lost their spouse again and says that she is free to marry whom she wishes only in the Lord, which is another phrase in 1 Corinthians 7 that we have to stop and wrestle with a little bit, okay? Again, one opinion would be that Paul is saying if you're going to remarry, marry in the Lord means marrying a Christian. That's what the Christian is required to do. The other would say that marrying in the Lord means marrying like obeying your parents in the Lord, means you marry kind of in view of your responsibility to God. You only marry if it's in keeping with God's commands, meaning you don't marry someone who's been divorced or who's committing adultery, not that you have to marry a Christian. I think, just spend 30 seconds on that thin ice out there, I think the New Testament assumes that a Christian will marry a Christian because that's what your whole kind of worldview is about, okay? But that's different than saying it's a sin and to repent, you have to put away your spouse and all that kind of stuff, which Paul has made clear in 1 Corinthians 7, okay? Now to the point that Brian alluded to, okay? Right in the heart of all this, I think Paul is, and I think Brian's point is well taken. It's helpful to say, okay, what's the principle here? Okay. One principle is that the form of this world is passing away. Regardless of the specific circumstances in Corinth, this is true for all of us. Okay, the form of the world is passing away. So, whatever circumstances we are in here and now, married, not married, we have possessions, we're sad, we're happy, okay, all these circumstances we're in, they're all temporary. To some degree, okay, even something as important as getting married, or the other things he mentions here, to some degree, that's just like rearranging chairs on the deck of the Titanic, right? I mean, the form of this world is passing away. Eternity is right around the corner, okay? The life, the order as we know it is coming to an end. And so Paul says that must be kept in mind. Does that negate the importance of marriage? Does that rule out passages like Ephesians 5? Of course not. But there always should be for the Christian this recognition of this. The time has been shortened. So, although I am married and need to treat that with the proper respect and attention that God commands, in the end, that is not, the eternal thing to be worried about, okay, or to be concerned with, okay? Think about maybe a parallel to what Jesus will say about, he who does not hate his father and mother, or he'll say, if you don't leave your family, right, to follow. Well, is Jesus saying literally you leave your family, you just abandon them on the side of the road with nothing to eat, No, the language of Jesus is about recognizing what is of ultimate value, ultimate importance, okay, and then treating everything else accordingly, okay. And I think Paul would say something similar here, even in regards to something of the magnitude of marriage. In the end, the form of this world is passing away. Don't forget that, okay? The other thing, and kind of on top of that, which I find to be helpful because of how jarring that kind of first point is, I think, to us, he says, really, what we're trying to do is promote undistracted devotion to the Lord. And that's what Brian referred to about the recognition that you are taking on extra responsibilities, distractions, we might say, in marrying and having a family, okay? Those things are of the Lord, they're good, they're holy, but they are still things that require our time and our attention. And we need to be honest about that. Marriage comes with its concerns. But notice in verse 35, he says, I say this for your benefit, not to restrain you. Paul is not trying to get us all worked up with anxiety and feeling like we're restrained. And, Paul, the Lord's putting me in this, what's it called? Straitjacket, Either to straitjack me in my singleness or straitjacket me in my marriage. Paul says, no, all that we're trying to do is to have our eyes wide open about what is most important, which is service to God, okay? And recognizing that our circumstances cannot stand in the way of that ultimate priority. Yes, Mike?
I feel like this reminds me about Paul's comments when he says, and when he talks about learning to be content in whatever circumstances he's in. That, you can serve God one way or the other. And, if you're in persecution, if you're not, if you're married, if you're not, you just learn to be content wherever you are, and you can serve God in that way no matter what you're dealing with.
Thank you, Mike. Other thoughts along these lines, comments, questions about this? All right. I never thought we'd make it through 1 Corinthians 7, but here we are. Actually, we're not quite done, because I do want us to talk about this a little bit. We did this, we tried to do this at the end of the two previous sections, okay? But if we think about our goals of this class, to understand what's going on in Corinth, to understand and appreciate Paul's solutions to their problems, and then to take all of that and then synthesize, the fancy word, that into our lives, weave it into our lives so that we can face the problems, the difficulties, the questions, the challenges, the things that we deal with as Christians in the 21st century. And so my question is this, and I'll give you some time to talk about it with people that are around you. If you haven't been here, we've been doing that, kind of sharing with those that are sitting close by. How can the principles, we talked about two of them this morning, this principle of contentment, Mike mentions that, okay, this principle of undistracted devotion that Brian drew our attention to, the time is shortened, remain as you, any of these things that are in 1 Corinthians 7 are principles that Paul is addressing. How can these things help us in our understanding of marriage and our practice of marriage in a tangible way? So what do I have here? I have 3 or 4 minutes maybe to talk about this with those around you. How can 1 Corinthians 7, not so much the specific instructions, but the big principles that Paul has laid out, how can those principles help us in our understanding of and our practice in marriage? All right, give you some time. Okay, so sounds like, at least from the murmuring, there's good conversations happening. Hopefully those will continue even after we're done here. But I do want to take 4 minutes or so, share something valuable that came out of the discussion that you were having with those around you. Brian, and then we have another microphone. Raise your hand and Nathan will come to you.
We discussed this, and I think perhaps the key principle is in verse 19. Nothing but what matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. You can tie that into the conclusion of Ecclesiastes, the whole duty of man. Galatians 5:6, nothing else matters but faith working through love. And why is all of that? Because this world is passing. Our griefs, our sorrows, our joys, our riches, makes no difference. It's all temporary, and every one of them serves the purpose of God. Therefore, make sure that you are fulfilling God's purpose for ourselves, and don't get tied up in the distractions of this world, and there are many. I look back on my life now, I have fewer being retired, but life gets in the way of spiritual health and physical health. So the world is passing, set your priorities.
Thank you, Brian. Other thoughts that came out of your discussions? Michael?
We've visited these thoughts before. It just seems to keep coming back. It occurred to me, you know, especially since this chapter, a lot of the context is like marriage, and I mean, society is probably a little bit different than it is their society than ours in some ways when they consider how they're doing marriage, but for a lot of the considerations people have today about marriage, it's usually what you want, you know, and what makes you happy, who's going to make me happy, you know, and it's all about that, you know, a selfish kind of desire in a way. That's part of the consideration, inevitably. And I don't know, it seems like, you know, what Paul centers on is, well, it just kind of made me think about how, yet again, you know, you have considerations, you have the selfishness battling the serving God. You know, you can serve yourself and your desires, and you know, and that can take away from your focus, you know, what you should be as a servant of God. Anyhow, it's just, that's where I ended up in my thoughts.
But I was just commenting on like that. You have to have your priorities straight. If your goal is to worship God and to focus your life on God, the rest of it should fall into place. And so, you know, if you look all the way back to the beginning with Genesis, I mean, it's clear that God's plan is for man and woman to be together. I mean, there's symbolism that just comes from that all across the entire Bible, that like that's God's plan. But this, I feel like in this instance, it says, depending on your circumstances, it's fine to be alone too. That your goal in life isn't to, you know, my goal in life is not to fulfill myself through marriage. My goal in life is to serve God. And if by being married, I can better serve God, then do that. If by not being married, I can better serve God, then do that. But the ultimate goal is to serve God. Society doesn't put it that way. It doesn't talk about it that way. It's you know, whatever makes me happy. If I'm going to get married to this person, if I'm not happy with them, I'm going to go with the other person. But that's their priority is all about self-fulfillment and about what makes me happy. And by putting the right perspective in the right place, one way or the other is fine as long as you're serving God.
No pressure. You know, what both Mike said is very valid. I think there's this interesting thing that happens initially when you get into a relationship. It's very much looking for something that's going to make my life better. You want to be with somebody that makes you happy. And then, you know, when you come to know the Lord, it's almost a similar thing where you want to get saved to save yourself. It's very self-serving purpose in a way. But there's this switch that happens, or that should happen, when you make that covenant to, from serving yourself to serving the other party that you've made that commitment to. And I think that's an important thing that we need to remember in both marriage and out of marriage, is the covenant that we have with God. And if you're married, the covenant that you have with God first and then with your spouse, to serve that person fully in everything that you do.
Thank you, Ian. All right, now we've finished chapter 7, and we'll move on. The rest of the time we have today, we'll maybe be able to cover all of chapter 8 and then pick up wherever we leave off on Wednesday. But, you know, I'm not going to let you get out of here without a quiz. So take 30 seconds here to stare at the outline with all of its blanks, and then I'll, in just a second, have you shout out what goes in these blanks. But this is about half of our outline through the book of 1 Corinthians. Okay, remember, once you've yelled one out, then you're out of the game. So everyone will be rushing. It'll be like a chorus for the first one. Everyone's trying to get that one. The first 9 verses of chapter 1. Introduction. Brian got that one, so he's out. The first 6 chapters, Paul is responding to reports. Terry. The first 4 chapters, it's a call to unity, okay, because there are factions in the church. Chapters 5 and 6 is a call to discipline. I'm going to give that one to Rick. And that's because there are reports of immorality and other bad behaviors amongst the brethren in those chapters. Then, from 7 to the end of the book, kind of, okay, Paul is responding to questions that they have. Terry, was that you? Okay, all right. Well, Alex took the fall on that one. It's very, very good of you. Okay, Paul is responding to questions that have been asked specifically in a letter, perhaps, by the Corinthians. 7 to 10 deals with what kind of matters? We're calling them personal. That doesn't mean they don't affect other people. That's kind of the opposite of what Paul will say. But they're things that, you know, my decisions that I'm doing in my life. And chapter 7 deals with marriage. Okay, hopefully you would get that one. Okay. The next thing is, after marriage, is this idea of food sacrifice to idols, and then Paul will deal with matters pertaining to the assembly, the whole group gathering together for worship, for edification, and then talk about the resurrection before he wraps up in chapter 16. But let's move on now to the next 3 chapters over the next 3 classes that deal with food offered to idols. This is weird to us. There are places in the world. Maybe some of you have been there. Was it you, Rick, that were telling me that story? Some of you have been places where this is a thing, that people still offer animal sacrifices to pagan gods or to idols. but in our day-to-day, maybe not as familiar. So real quickly, I just kind of set the stage for you, and you've probably heard some of this before, and I think it's will be fairly intuitive why Paul needs to address this. Okay, so at pagan temples in a place like Corinth, there was a place in Corinth in particular called the Asclepion. Okay, it was, you know, the American Medical Association has like the serpent on the pole thing, okay? That's part of the symbol for this this god of healing in Corinth, Asclepion, not just in Corinth, but there is a temple there. And so someone in Corinth might go to this pagan temple and make a sacrifice. It's part of their culture. And so you bring your animal and you make your sacrifice, and different things would be done with that meat, okay? And this probably sounds familiar for another reason too, because some of that meat would be actually eaten by the priests and those that are administering the sacrifices. And then some of that meat would be eaten. By the way, what does that remind you of? Yeah, in the law of Moses, there were similar commands for some of the sacrifices that would be shared with the priest, eaten by the offerer, and then some of it consumed. They were not all that way, but some of them were, okay? That eating of the meat could be done in a few different ways. Oftentimes, there was a dining room, a banquet room, just off of where worship and the sacrifice was done. So you'd go then and have a feast with that meat that you sacrificed and eat the food there. Sometimes that would be taken and sold in a marketplace, okay? The meat would be. And sometimes it would be served in a home setting. Do I have this? Yeah, I do have these two things here. Could be served in a home setting where you'd be invited over to someone's house and they say, we have this meat, it's been sacrificed in honor of so-and-so person or god or goddess, and it would be served there. Okay. As you can imagine, Christians that were formerly pagans and did this on a regular basis now have to wrestle with the ethics of this. Is this okay to do this? Is it okay to go? Is it okay to eat? Is it okay to eat there? Is it okay to eat anywhere? They had to wrestle with this. And let me just point out real quickly, just for clarification's sake, this is not quite the same as what Paul addresses in Romans 14, okay? There are some clear overlaps here in terms of the principles or the commands. But remember in Romans 14, which we studied not that long ago, the situation there is pertaining to Jews that eat kosher and the Gentiles don't, and so how do you, you know, deal with those relationships where some people eat according to the customs of the law of Moses, some people don't, certain foods were considered unclean, now everything's clean, but how do we deal with that in a community of Christians? That's different than what this is, and so probably good to have in our mind exactly what was going on, or more exactly what's going on as we jump into it. Okay, so Paul opens it up. This was apparently something that they asked about, although it's possible that maybe Paul is just bringing it up. But let's just read chapter 8. It's not very long, as you see, and at least get the words in front of us to start out. 1 Corinthians 8 reads, "Now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge makes arrogant, but love edifies. If anyone supposes that he knows anything, he is not yet known as he ought to know, but if anyone loves God, he is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there is no such thing as an idol in the world, and that there is no God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for him. And one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through him. However, not all men have this knowledge, but some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol, for their conscience, being weak, is defiled. For food will not commend us to God. We are neither the worse if we do not eat, nor the better if we do eat. But take care that this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if someone sees you who have knowledge dining in an idol's temple, will not this conscience, his conscience, if he is weak, be strengthened to eat things sacrificed to idols? For through your knowledge, he who is weak is ruined, the brother for whose sake Christ died. And so by sinning against the brethren and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food causes my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause my brother to stumble." Okay, there's the question, and we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I would rather think you discuss it than us open this up right at the moment. So take a minute to discuss or so with those around you. In chapter 8 that we just read, what are the benefits, what are the pitfalls of what Paul refers to as knowledge? Talk about that for a couple minutes. Okay, we just have a few minutes. As you know, the first bell has already ringed. And so let's actually bypass the sharing out and then just run through this one slide I have on chapter 8. And then if I feel like there's something more to say about this on Wednesday, we'll pick up there. Please let me know if something was not adequately addressed, and we can answer that question when we start on Wednesday. This is the big verse, your memory work verses, that knowledge, Paul says, puffs up, but love edifies. By the way, there's a couple points in this chapter where Paul says, we know that, like in chapter 8, verse 1, we know we all have knowledge, but, okay, or he'll say, verse 4, we know that there is no such thing as an idol in the world, okay? There's a question there. When it says we know, that could, as we've seen before, be the Corinthians saying. That's the Corinthians' words. We know all have knowledge, okay? And, but Paul is saying, but wait a second, okay? Knowledge makes arrogant, puffs up, but love builds up. Well, how in the world is that the case? Well, we know some things related to this scenario. We know idols aren't real. We know there's no such thing as an idol. We know the Shema that Steve has talked about recently, the Lord your God, the Lord is one, okay? There is no God but one. That's the great monotheistic statement of the Old Testament. By the way, Paul does something amazing with that. The monotheistic claim of Deuteronomy 6, there's no God but one. Well, yeah, the one God is the Father, and the one Lord is Jesus, okay? And he's talked about already in this book about the Spirit of God dwelling with his people in this holy temple. And so the great claim of one God exhibited in the Father, God, the Father, and the Lord, Jesus, okay? So we know that. And so what's the big deal with, you know, eating this meat? Well, Paul says you also have to consider that some may have a weak conscience. They've been doing this all their life. They've always associated this with worship of an idol. By the way, they may have good reason for that. I mean, sitting down in the ancient world to share a meal was a sign of fellowship. So sitting at a table in an idol's temple, some are going to be offended by that. They're going to have a weak conscience. By the way, Paul says, I think that was a bell, it doesn't help you to eat. This is it's a important point we don't want to miss. The thing that we do that, it's not a sin to do it, Paul says, well, you're not any better off for doing it, and you're not any worse off if you don't do it, okay? So think about the other person. We'll pick up there in the middle of our discussion of chapter 8, hopefully get through chapter 9 as well, and I would like to give you a midterm at some point of some kind, so that probably will happen Wednesday. And then no one shows up Wednesdays.